This edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound, was first broadcast on the 25th of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 37th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week, as we celebrate England's summer solstice with brollies and galoshes, barbers and boots, we head to the sun slightly and stay at home some other times. Here's what our trug basket of wind-battered blooms looks like. We get all mad men as we look for ad men under the southern French sun, visiting the Cannes Lions advertising jamboree.
You're seeing kind of like the smaller, scrappy agencies for the first time actually being able to compete with the kind of like larger established like multinational holding companies.
We venture to the prettiest stretch of the Thames, up Hurley Way, to visit one of the smallest, most well-formed literary festivals.
There is still this thing where if you like a book and you tell your friend that you liked a book, they'll pick that book up and they'll read it. If one person goes out of this place with debut novelist from a literary publisher and says, look, I love this book, you've got to read it, that's a win for them.
We jump to Catalonian Sun to wonder what magazine the stars and revelers at Barcelona's Sonar Electronic Arts Festival are reading in their green rooms off the Ramblas.
Because I'm flying and travelling, I'm always reading a lot of magazines, and my two top ones are The Economist and a funny magazine called Monocle.
Plus a wonderful live session from and a chat with Australian superstar Angus Stone and the runners and riders for London's 2012 festival. That little lot will be all right here in the next hour on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. First up, yeah, you got it, a song from this week's Midori House session by Angus Stone. For a few years, half of brother, sister, Joe, Angus and Julia Stone, Angus has gone it alone to write, record and tour the imminent debut album Broken Brights. This, sung live for us last week, is Wooden Chair. And with some fine whistling, that was Angus Stone performing Wooden Chair from his upcoming debut album, Broken Brights. There'll be more from that much-admired Midori House session later on. Now, if you were anybody in the world of advertising last week, you would have been at, or had your eyes glued on, Cannes, where the global advertising, marketing, PR and communications industry were gathered. Taking place at the 59th annual Cannes Lions Festival of Creativity, which brings together professionals from across the sector to learn, discuss, celebrate, network, schmutz, and occasionally have a glass of rosé or three on the odd sun terrace or private yacht too. Make no mistake, even the most cynical of bystanders will still agree that winning a Cannes Lions Grand Prix is the equivalent of bagging an Oscar. We dispatched culture producer Katie Bilboa down there to soak up a bit of sun and investigate where the real innovation is coming from in this rapidly changing industry.
The monolithic Palais Festival Conference Centre in Cannes is buzzing. Outside, on the sun-drenched La Croisette Strip, in the midday heat, people are milling around in shorts and T-shirts. Giant inflatables, stalls and stages showcase the likes of Yahoo, Google and Velti, while others relax on boats out in the Mediterranean. When the Templars murdered my family, when the whole bloody world's gone crazy. Inside, a cinema auditorium is packed with enthusiastic onlookers. They watch eagerly as leaders from global advertising agency BBDO explain the thinking behind their latest projects.
I think you can tell with this piece that the idea is all, and it was a reductionist, simple idea. The players that the guy uses in the game celebrate him for helping them succeed. So that's a great idea.
I'm at the 59th Cannes Lions Festival of Creativity. Once billed as the summer holiday of the advertising world, this year a record 11,000 delegates from the world of creative communications have descended on France's south coast. But it's not all just about applause and backpatting. Nor is it just about the parties, spritzers and long hours in the sun that may have once defined this event. Terry Savage is chair of the festival.
Once upon a time it was more about the parties and the beaches, but in the last 10 years the reality of the awards has always been high, but the inspiration, of course, from seeing great work leaves people on a high, leaves people with aspirations to try and achieve the same. Networking is key, because where else can you go for a week and talk to your peers, exchange ideas, and generally enjoy each other's company, no matter which network or which company you're from?
One of the big shifts this year is the abundance of brands who've chosen to take part. Over 550 have rocked up to the event. Outside the towering convention centre in the blazing sunshine, Colin Nagy from creative agency Barbarian Group explains.
A lot of the brands are here to kind of figure out who's really doing the most interesting stuff, and they're spending a lot of time on the ground meeting with smaller interesting shops. People are kind of like ravenously searching for answers as more like brand dollars are migrating online, and you know, it gets harder to get your message out, so I think finding the most kind of creative ways to do that is really important.
One such brand is Smirnoff, part of the Diageo family. The brand's vice president for global marketing, Michelle Klein, thinks that being present at the festival offers greater opportunities for the product.
I feel good that my boss and his boss are here because it means that they get to see so much and understand. I mean, they know, but they get to sort of be part of this experience. And I think the other thing that it does, you know, we're sitting outside the Palais right now and Bill Clinton's about to join an agency on stage. You know, the best thing that happened to me this week was meeting John Hamm in full character as Don Draper. So, you know, I think the brands and the big companies end up bringing in, you know, some great speakers and great celebrities, and it becomes more than just one person on stage talking about what they know about, you know, tracking advertising to a really fantastic lineup.
But beyond all the glitz of celebrity and the opportunity for learning and networking, let's not forget those awards. And what have the best global ideas been this year? One thing that everyone's talking about is the Nike Fuel Band, a bracelet which tracks your activity throughout the day. It won agency RGA New York the Cyber Grand Prix and could herald a new way of approaching branding, as Colin explains.
It's an ongoing iterative, almost like a piece of software, whereas like a campaign stops and starts. I think the idea of these brands doing interesting products is going to be something that kind of continues to grow.
So with bigger budgets to realise ambitious ideas like this, do smaller companies and agencies stand a chance against the Goliaths? Or is it still the Saatchi and Saatchis of the world who are driving the creativity and innovation? For Colin, the industry is in a period of transition.
You're seeing kind of like the smaller, scrappy agencies for the first time actually being able to compete with the kind of like larger established like multinational holding companies. The small, cool, entrepreneurial creative shop in Helsinki or Sao Paulo now can actually put out work and create work that doesn't require monstrous media spends, where it's a little bit more of a meritocracy. And I think that's a good thing, both because, you know, I support small entrepreneurs and, you know, I respect that. And also, you know, it keeps everyone sharp and it keeps everyone honest. You know, it raises the bar for a lot of people.
Terry Savage agrees that it's not just about the big conglomerates.
You do see smaller agencies that are rooted in creativity winning here and probably punching well above their weight. And that happens with some countries too. I mean, Australia wins a lot here. Comparative to the size of the country. New Zealand does very well here. It really comes down to the fact that scale is obviously important, but great talent through the independent system always shines through at Cannes.
So what medium has been the most innovative at this year's festival? Michelle Klein again.
The best ideas I saw this week were coming out of the mobile category, and it was just innovative, it was breakthrough, they were driving sales and conversion for brands, they were driving equity, they were engaging communities and doing things that you just cannot do through traditional advertising. So, I mean, it sounds silly to say that's one to watch because, you know, we've been talking about mobile for years, but certainly I've seen a seismic shift in the last week around the focus and attention that that's going to get.
Terry agrees that these newer platforms are where the most creative ideas can be found.
If I was sitting here 5 years ago, I would have said, well, look, I think the industry is struggling with digital. Doesn't quite get it, doesn't quite understand it. That certainly is not the case now. You can see the whole festival is emerged in digital, and they're using social networks, all sorts of platforms in a unique and interesting and innovative way. And I think that's where you're seeing most of the innovation that is coming through at the festival this year.
So are the traditional advertising platforms being left behind? And what about our old pal radio? Thankfully, the world is not a homogenised place, and different markets still have different needs. Brent Singer and his colleague Jenny Glover, also a creative director at BBDO Advertising Agency in Johannesburg, won a Grand Prix award last year and several gold medals this year, all for radio advertising.
It's the same answer that is true of any medium, is that if you have a really exciting insight and you've got a really cool idea, then you execute it in a good way. That makes for something that is not staid and not boring and interesting to listen to as a consumer.
I don't think we particularly look at reinventing the medium each time we do a piece of work. We just kind of, we utilize the medium for what it's best for. And I mean, in a sense, if you've got a captive audience, why not tell them a story or paint a picture for them? I mean, it's the same as a print ad doesn't necessarily have to make a sound when you open it.
Who do you think the other key players and agencies are that are doing interesting and good things in radio that you kind of look to or you admire?
For years there was a great campaign called Real Men of Genius, which came out of, I think, out of Chicago, DDB, and I mean that was really great, and it's just one of those campaigns that kind of kept giving and giving and giving. And at the moment, I mean, I think that there are a lot of good radio writers out there in the world, and it's hard to kind of put down one specific area because, I mean, great stuff comes out of New York, great stuff's come out of Portland this year.
Terry Savage sees a positive future for the radio industry.
Radio is going through the same process as everything else. You're a web-based radio station. There will be innovations and changes in your business just like in all of the other businesses, but it will come down to two things. Have you got great content? Do people want to listen? I think as a medium, most people involved in the creative sphere would say it's a very powerful one.
As the sun sets over Cannes, the eager delegates queuing to see Bill Clinton still have time to catch a bit of sun, and no doubt the odd cocktail or two. And despite the talk of innovation and creativity, it's clear that one thing remains unchanged. Good ideas drive everything. And a great idea really can come from anywhere. For Monocle, in Cannes, I'm Katie Bilboa.
And thank you very much to the wonderful Katie Bilboa for her fascinating report there from Cannes. You are tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bound, and we'll be back with a trip to a grand pub to listen to notable people reading books after this.
Premiering on Monocle.com, a film about the city we feel ranks number one for quality of life. Monocle's annual survey goes beyond the basic economic and social aspects of a city, identifying often overlooked factors that can bring happiness and ease to everyday life. And for the second time running, climbing back up to the number one spot, it's Zurich.
On a sunny early summer's day in Zurich, a handful of its residents have made their way to Badi Enge, one of several bathing houses situated along the waterfront, offering decks for sunbathing, bars, and even saunas. The scene is especially notable for taking place minutes from downtown, and it's what sets Zurich immediately apart. This is a city with abundant and interconnected green space, cut through by rivers leading to its lake, all of it set up to be enjoyed by the population.
You can watch this film, plus our top 25 most livable city countdown, on monocle.com.
And for those of you just joining us, you're listening to Culture on Monocle 24, where now we head up London's Thames till it becomes Berkshire's Thames. We jump off the train at Maidenhead and then head into the country where old Father Thames is narrower, darker, secret-filled and willow-shaded. Here at Hurley is the Old Bell Inn, a coaching tavern since the 12th century that, on the day I went, was playing proud host to what must be one of the world's smallest literary festivals. Picador Books, that estimable British publisher, is celebrating its 40th this year, and it took some of its mates down the boozer to celebrate. I took the bullet and went down the Old Bell for Picador's birthday bash, and first of all, I talked to Stuart Evers, author of 10 stories about smoking, it was him that was having a cigarette, and his upcoming debut novel, If This Is Home, about how to do a reading at a literary festival.
Basically, what you want to do is try and get something which doesn't need too much explaining. You know, my previous book was a collection of stories, which means it's quite easy because you just read a story, so it's self-contained. What I tried to do was to try and find something that would sum up the main character and that's also got a bit of humour to it, because the humour is very important, I think, in writing in general, but, you know, it plays an important part in the book in many ways. And it also keeps people interested. So keep it short. Make sure there's a couple of laughs, even if it's just a knob gag.
Always helps.
Always helps. But yeah, that's how I choose it. And then I chose another piece which is more about the other strand to the novel. So there's two strands to the novel, and this is the other strand, which again was a short piece which just gave you a flavour of the atmosphere of a small town in the late 80s, early 90s.
And you talked about your mates in the music business. I guess you were sort of alluding to the fact that everyone thinks they'll play Wembley one day or whatever. Doing literary festivals and reading from your book and making people laugh, making people think and consider everything, that's one of the stages on the way to Wembley, isn't it? So it's a kind of, does it sort of bring it home to you and make it real when you stand up and read your book in front of people? That's not a strange question.
It doesn't make it any more real. What it does give you is an avenue to talk to people who may have read it or perhaps haven't read it and might be interested to read it. You know, it's always good not to be in a complete vacuum. And, you know, some of these events are like wonderful, and like today's has been, you know, a joy, and, you know, get to meet some different people in a different part. Other ones can be more problematic. There have been instances where people have said less than complimentary things about what you're reading.
Presumably people don't heckle a literary event, do they?
There was one instance, I won't say where, but there was a woman who took me to task because I was talking about how humour is intrinsic human need and that novels that don't reflect that aren't reflecting humanity in all of its forms. And she accused me of trying to be a stand-up comedian. And I couldn't... as far as I could work out, stand-up comedian was there with fascist dictator and, you know, sort of killer of kittens. She said it was such force, but it wasn't quite a heckle, but it was kind of, I'm not really sure how to react to that.
That was Stuart Evers in the perhaps unique position of being half heckled at a high-minded book reading. Next, Picador's publisher, Paul Bagley, told me about the importance to his authors of getting out there to read out loud.
Not every writer has to do this, but we do remind them that it does help enormously. And if I look at the authors who we've been most successful with recently, it's helped hugely by their profile, and that would include someone like Caroline Duffy, who has transformed the role of poet laureate, and that has helped her reach a wider readership, or Alan Hollinghurst, who, despite being the most intellectual and erudite author you could come across, I was at Latitude with him last year. It was his first pop festival, as he liked to call it, that he'd ever been to, but he stood up in a tent and spoke to an adoring number of people. And that openness to do that kind of thing is hugely helpful. The pleasure of meeting people who love your books is huge. The other thing I think they really like is meeting other writers. And we do a lot with young writers, and three were here today with their first novels. And actually being able to share experiences is a really important part of building a community.
Yeah, there seems to be quite a lot of, we were talking to Stuart earlier, he was very much talking about, you know, a lot of people ask him sort of how you get it published when you go to the boutique book club, I think. And I guess that's always a preoccupation. I guess no matter how big your name becomes an author, you still need to hang out with your peers, don't you?
Yes, I think I think there are different discussions at different stages of lives, in the same way that as a writer you need different levels of editing at different stages of your careers. I remember going to a first novels festival many years ago, and it was a slightly scary discussion, certainly if you're a publisher, of young writers discussing their advances, their potential film deals, and the number of launch parties they were getting. Perhaps your preoccupations change as you...
Literary top trumps.
Absolutely. I'll swap you a film deal for a launch party.
Yeah, I suppose it is rather terrifying, but presumably, and finally, this, the festival circuits, is it very important to you to, as I say, raising the profile of books, authors, poets, etc.? It must be, you know, increasingly big thing, the live event.
It is, and, you know, for Picador, it's also about raising the idea of our brand. It's 40 years of publishing writers in a particular area, and a difficult and challenging area, but one which, when it works, can be hugely successful. And we don't have huge amounts of money to spend on advertising and enormous poster campaigns. So getting our writers to readers is the way we try and market ourselves, and making it an unintimidating way of doing this. So you don't have to be part of some salon or some kind of elite. It's actually anyone who cares about books is welcome to come along.
It sounds so efficient, fashioned. It must be the future, Paul.
People reading books and talking about them is old-fashioned, but it is absolutely the future. The means of doing it sometimes changes, but it's what gets us all excited every day.
And there you heard it from the Picador boss. It's all about reading and talking about books. How refreshing. John Ronson, that well-known student of the strange, was also at the Old Bell to talk about the weird and wonderful behind the title of his latest book, The Psychopath Test, a typically head-first and hands-on investigation into the world of psychiatry. When he has to meet so many frightening people, how does he psych himself up, I wondered?
I'm intensely nervous and I hate it. I've always thought the fact that I hate doing these things, I hate putting myself in dangerous situations, and I hate, you know, and I'm quite shy, so I hate, you know, having to convince strangers to talk to me. I always think the fact that I hate doing it is the reason why I should do it. And yeah. I look back on all the adventures I did in the psychopath test. I look back at them all as like, you know, I had to take Valium. I was so nervous for a lot of them. But you sort of know in the back of your head that the more unpleasant it is, the better it will be on the page.
And the better for you. You say you're timid, but you're attracted to all these nutty subjects.
Yeah, well, it's because...
That's a fascinating subject, but maybe that's why.
Well, I only have one way of telling a story, which is to go off and experience it myself. And the stories that I tell work best when they're in extreme places, sort of shadowlands and you know, mysterious places with mysterious people, which are quite often, you know, anxiety-inducing places to go to. So that's the reason why I have to do it all the time. It's the only way I can tell stories, and it's the telling of the stories that's the thing that, you know, I don't know what I'd do if I couldn't do that. So the actual journeys are the very unpleasant, for me personally, the kind of unpleasant thing I have to do to make the stories work.
And why are you compelled to follow these menaces?
I think I asked Randy Newman that very question. I said to him, why do you write songs? And he said, it's how I judge myself and it's how I feel better. And I think there's no better way of...
If you've asked that question to Randy Newman, I feel I'm glad that it wasn't such a bad question to ask.
It's a good and the answer I have the same. I refer you to Randy Newman's answer.
Read Newman. Yeah. And just finally, the subject of lots of work is this... There's a strangeness, this thing that the veneer on the world, the sort of attractive pattern on the world only hides the kind of, you know, huge core and magma of weirdness. Yes. Do you think, in your estimation, do you think that there are still a million great stories out there? Do you think there is still a million weirdnesses to be discovered in your books and films and your work?
I fucking hope so.
Is the world getting weirder or more normal, I wonder?
Well, there's certainly worlds I can think very easily of two or three worlds that I haven't touched that are as big and important as the military, like I did in Goetzen, and psychiatry that I did in the psychopath test, that are just as irrational, just as important and powerful and just as irrational. So there's no doubt about that. But that's not enough. Within that, you then need to find like an amazing transcendent narrative. And that's, for me, that's the hard part.
And that was the ever passionate John Ronson. Of course, someone has to interview all these crazy writers at an event like this. In this case, it was Paul Wilson, a voracious reader, a devourer of proofs and hardbacks himself, and a contributor to many a magazine on the subject.
I was happy to interview a novelist because I like book writers and novelists. Comparing what I do to what those people do in terms of making words and stuff, I never say I'm a writer. When people say, what do you do for a living? I always say I work for magazines. People who write something from nothing, as in, I have to make a book. No one's commissioning them. Even authors who are commissioned to write, but even Ian Rankin commissioned to write his next Rebus novel. Yeah, he's got that commission, but no one's telling him what that is. He has to invent it from nothing. He might have the financial security and the knowledge of eight novels behind him in order to start the ninth, but it's just to flipping do it. When I get commissioned to write 500 words on an author, just do it. It's not the same thing. It's a craft. That's when journalism or whatever becomes a craft. Those people do an art, and I'm not an artist. I'm not going to say I'm a craftsman, that's the wrong thing, but I apply a craft.
Paul Wilson, are you a craftsman?
Not really. If someone gives me a word hole to fill on a page, I'll fill it. That's it.
And is it sort of instructive, though, nonetheless, to listen to writers talking about what they do? It's a very foreign universe, sitting in a room writing, whether it's your kitchen, whether it's the study, the sort of longed-for study that Stuart was talking about, looking out over the river.
The place where one writes, like, yeah, where your window overlooks a river and you have peace all day and all that stuff.
Visible otters.
Exactly, wonderful. Yeah, visible otters. wonderful thing to think of. But, yeah, I'm a million miles away from those things. That's why I love the people who do something creative or artistic off their own bat fascinate me, because, yes, in almost all situations they have to do it, they're compelled. Other times, yeah, we've already done an album, let's do another one. We've already written a book, let's do another one. But the creative process, I love reading about how films were made or how films didn't get made, or how an author took 10 years to do this, or how a follow-up album took Guns N' Roses 20 years and $50 million. That, the interest in the creative process, for me, is something I'll always find fascinating.
What do you hope when you interview an author on a day like today, what do you hope the crowd kind of go away with?
I think today particularly that there were three debut novelists, and then there was John Ronson, who everyone's heard of, and particularly, like, John's done TV and he's had a book made into a film, but also his third book now has sold more books than anything else, so he's got more people reading. And I think that applies to those three debut novelists, that if one person leaves the room with their book, I know that's not a great hit rate, maybe, but I think it is. There is still this thing where if you like a book and you tell your friend that you liked a book, they'll pick that book up and they'll read it. If one person goes out of this place with debut novelist from a literary publisher and says, look, I love this book, you've got to read it, that's a win for them.
And thank you, Stuart Evers, Paul Bagley, John Ronson and Paul Wilson there. And that, boys and girls, was what happens after a day on the Gamay and Roast Lamb and books and expansive gardens at Bell Stories, a Picador literary day at the old Bell Hurley. Ding dong. Still to come in part two of Culture, we play you a bit more from Angus Stone's lovely Midori House session. We'll hear what magazines musicians take with them on tour, and we'll see what all the fuss is about behind the unveiling of the grand finale of London's Cultural Olympiad. That's all right here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. First of all, in part two, is the second of the tracks that Angus Stone laid down for us last week at his Midori House session. This is Bird on a Buffalo. We'll be right back.
so convinced, yet of the change in the wind, the lighthouse man turned and whispered me some things. He said we don't sleep, stuck in the dream. I shot my baby with an arrow in the wind. You, me, and them. We got together and we did our thing. Through stormy weather. The change in the wind, the watch tower man turned and whispered me some things. He said we don't sleep, awake in the dream. He shot my baby with an arrow.
Bird on a Buffalo by Angus Stone, who hung around for a minute or two afterwards to sign some staff bras and for a chat with me.
Well, we used to live here a while back.
Right.
I guess that was the first sort of road that we went down.
But you've been whizzing around Europe, Amsterdam, Berlin, bits and bobs, I think.
Yes.
Kind of testing out the best European audiences.
Yeah, we kind of...
Drawing a graph of them.
we've had the scroll of the blueprints open. But yeah, we've kind of just been, it's been pretty chilled actually, just doing these showcases where we play the record and the fans win the tickets from the website or something, and they all come along and listen to the record and we walk out and we play a few songs. And I don't know, it's just cool. You're sitting at the bar drinking with them and talking and sharing stories and then playing a little show.
You have effusive fans, don't you?
Yeah, there's some really...
Sparkling, I see. There's a lot of sparkling eyes in the audience today.
Yeah, there's some cool people that listen to the music, for sure.
And Broken Brights is the new record out next month. It's out in Australia. Is it one of these staggered things, or does it make sense? Is it out at the same time all over the world, the record?
I think it is coming out at the same time everywhere. The staggered thing, it's always, you know, it can turn stagnant in a way, in your heart, you know? You sort of, like, these reasons are for something else other than just releasing music.
I never quite understand that thing.
Yeah, it becomes complicated. But yeah, we're lucky it's coming out at the same time everywhere, and Yeah.
What does Broken Brights, Broken Brights is the name of the RP. Where does that name come from?
I've been shooting a lot with Super 8 recently.
Okay.
And I went to the Redwoods in California and with my love, and I'm really fascinated with film and just the magic and the unknown about it. And there was one moment, I don't know if you know much the Super 8 cameras, but when light comes in and you're shooting up directly at the light, the shutter shuts off because it's too much.
Okay.
And it sort of shuts down and goes black, and then it opens up again when you sort of brush past a leaf or something that sort of blocks the light. And I was in the editing suite looking back at it, and it reminded me when you sort of look up to the canopy without a camera in your eye, you get that sort of shard of broken bright.
That's the best description anyone's ever given for the name of a song or album. We're going to put that, we should just take that one thing out and put it, blast it from the rooftops of Midori House. I love that, and it's a sort of poetic idea, and the record however sounds a bit more stripped up, and your session that you just performed to us sounds a bit more stripped up than some of your stripped down stuff that you've done with Julia.
Yeah, it's just me and Rob.
Yeah.
Rob and I. We've been
like, are you correcting?
My
teacher, what am I gonna say? Angus, it's Rob and I.
Yeah.
Okay.
My mum was an English teacher. And she always used to beat that into me. we've been turning up to shows. Like today, the engineer, we got Paul up, and because I really wanted to play electric on the last song. And the drummer, he just came in this morning as well. So
right. We've
sort of just at the last minute been sort of pulling strings.
This is amazing. This is the new lineup.
Yeah.
We're going to miss Paul Noble, but hey.
Yeah.
And doing it like that, and I guess having a bit of a bigger band sound, is that something that's kind of important when you're touring? Because depending upon the size of the venue, I guess intimacy can sometimes be lost, can't it, in the size of some of the venues?
It is. For this record, when we hit the road with the band, and it's going to be theatres, and it's going to be a full band where there's going to be five people. But for this, it was really last minute. I had a week before. Kathy was like, "Oh, you should go and do these showcases in Europe and UK." And I was like, "Okay." And then all of a sudden, I was flashed here,
like in Star Trek, just appeared.
Yeah,
there's a weird silvery science fiction sound, and you just appeared.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks for doing that. Thanks for testing the technology. Yeah. And that was Angus Stone talking about the story behind some of the things that went into Broken Brights, his debut solo LP, which is out mid-July. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. We're off to Barcelona for Sonar after this.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly business briefing, looking at the most inspiring people, places and ideas from around the world. Whether it's a bookshop owner in Toronto with a smart new business model, a fast food entrepreneur taking Japan by storm, or a local bank CEO providing microfinancing in Kenya, our correspondents and editors are on hand to provide insight into self-started success. Each week we'll be talking to enterprising people who have taken the leap and followed their dreams to set out on their own.
This is not just purely a business. This is a lifestyle. It's fun. It's great. I wake up in the morning, every morning, excited about it. What are these crazy ideas going around in my head?
From branding your company to finding startup financing and surviving the tough times, we cover the full range of what it takes to turn an idea into a thriving business. All told through personal stories from real people finding success by following their ambitions. That's The Entrepreneurs every Wednesday at 1900 UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
All right, welcome back to Culture. Asking people about their reading habits at music festivals is not typical behaviour, especially at the recent Sonar Music Festival in Barcelona, which saw a record-breaking 98,000 people brave the three-day-long event. Yet our correspondent decided to brave the puzzled looks and the eclectic mix of international DJs and performers and go ahead and ask them what they're reading anyway. Call him crazy, call him misguided, or call him a media geek. We at Monocle just like to call him Liam Alders. Here he is from Barcelona.
Hey, this is Flying Lotus. I've been reading this book called The Visible Man by Chuck Klosterman, and I've been reading Damned by Chuck Palahniuk, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good book.
It's weird, man.
What about if you had to read a magazine on a plane, what would you read?
If I had to read a magazine on the plane, that's a good one. I really like the Popular Science magazine. And, you know, Monocle ain't bad either.
And what's your favorite radio station and why?
I love K-Day in L.A. because they play a lot of stuff that I grew up with. More 90s hip-hop, you know, 90 to 95, 99 hip-hop, where it's actually kind of old school now. And I never thought I would be old school. My music would be old school. But it's old school now. So, yeah, I love it. I love hearing, like, a lot of the hip-hop that I was in high school for.
Jesse Borgen's the third. It's gonna sound weird, but I kind of like, I don't want to say it, like Mary Claire, and I get into a lot of like Nylon, and that's pretty much it, really. I try to keep it like that, and everything else is usually books. I read like The Alchemist is my favorite book, and The Heart of Tantric Sex is another book that I recommend you should read by Diane Richardson from South Africa. It's really, really well written. Kind of stuff I've been doing lately.
Well, I can't let you get away with it. Why do you read Marie Claire?
I love women, you know what I mean, and I love women culture, and I want some insight. like any dude should want some insight if you love women, you know what I mean. Cheat codes.
Again, the other question is, what radio do you listen to and why?
I listen to NPR. That's about it, really. Because they actually bring the culture and refreshing new music to the forefront. But as far as other radio stations go, I don't really do that. I feel like a lot of radio stations on the net and via, like, you know, 90 FMs and AMs, they don't necessarily try to educate people on new music or even refresh people on old music that is the reason why new music is here, like the influences. You know, there's not a lot of history lessons on the radio. Like, you play the same songs all the time, which is cool, you know. But it's like going to a DJ set and hearing them play 2 hours of house music and it's the same tempo every song, you know what I mean? Like, I want variety. I want to know, like, I want you to educate me, like, this is what's hot right now and such. Like, only other radio station I really listen to is Giles, BBC, but that's it, you know, and Benji. That's it. But those are the homies, though, so that's it, yeah.
Okay, so I'm just here with Richie Horton, and he's going to tell me what he's reading at the moment.
Well, I it was my birthday a couple of days ago, so a friend just gave me the new Steve Jobs biography. So that's the next book I'm going to read. And because I'm flying and traveling, I'm always reading a lot of magazines. And my two top ones are The Economist and a funny magazine called Monocle.
Oh, really?
Yeah, since...
That's not a plug.
It's one of the only magazines that I know that really is on the pulse of creativity and business on a worldwide level, and I'm sitting on a plane, maybe as much as your editor in chief, and you know, so it's definitely a bit of my Bible.
It's good to know. And what about radio? Do you listen to much internet radio or local radio stations at home?
I'm listening to some podcasts, but those are mostly non-editorial and just music, just to find out what's going on the landscape. There's a great one from Berlin called Wax Treatment, which is a bit more dubby and, like Jamaican nearly, but quite minimalistic, because that's the kind of sound I like. And there's a great one for people trying to get into electronic music. Resident Advisor has a great podcast that is a great way to find out what's happening in my scene.
My name is Nikolai, I'm the lead singer in When Saints Go Machine, and I read Time magazine while I'm sitting on the toilet. I, I don't want to piss anyone off, but I don't really listen to that much radio. I'm from Copenhagen, so, I mean, we've got public radio, and at night there's this channel that plays classical music, and I only listen to the radio while I'm in the shower, so, but it gives you, it's kind of fun, you know, having a shower, listening to classical music makes it seem, more special than it is.
And that was Liam Aldous reporting for us from the Sonar Music and Electronic Arts Festival in Barcelona. And I think a few of his interviewees there might have had a sherry or two in whatever form the kids take sherry these days. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Now, when the modern Olympic Games started, they weren't just about people with big muscles running around in tiny shorts. A young Frenchman called Baron Pierre de Coubertin, who founded the Olympic Committee, wanted the event to be a combination of sport, culture and education. It was with that in mind that the bid for London 2012 was made, and since the 2008 Games ended in Beijing, a cultural Olympiad programme has been underway across the UK. It's the largest cultural celebration in the history of the modern Olympic and Paralympic movements, and it culminates now with the London 2012 Festival, which started last week. My inspiring producer, Katie Bilboa, caught up with Tony Hall, chair of the Cultural Olympiad Board, at the launch of the event, to hear more.
To my mind, this is an amazing opportunity for us to show off the wealth and breadth of arts and culture, not just in London, but right across the country, and showcase that not only to ourselves, that's kind of important, but also to the whole world, because the eyes of the world are upon us for the Olympic Games.
And how much of the festival is about British talent, or how much of it is international artists coming over and taking part as well?
It's completely both, which represents what London and the UK kind of stands for. You know, we are a magnet for artists from around the world. We are also an amazingly artistic, cultural, creative nation. So we've got artists coming, I mean, thousands of artists taking part, coming from over 206 different countries around the world. So it's a kind of a real melting pot of art and culture in this city, which is sort of what the UK stands for, and I think that's great.
So looking at London specifically, how much of a role do you think culture plays in putting London on the world stage alongside other cities, and how important to London is culture?
Oh, I think it's phenomenally important. One of the things that people put very, very high up on the agenda for coming to London is they want to go and see the culture, the museums, the galleries, the theatre, and so on and so on and so on. So it's as much a business, in, to be honest with you, as it is, you know, a good thing for the soul. And what I hope is that the chance we now have to showcase this with all, I mean, there's something like over 40,000 journalists around for the Games, to showcase just how good we are, that's a wonderful opportunity to also to sell this country to the world and then generate tourism and the benefits that come from that.
And just to get a sense, how long has this been in the making? How long have you been planning it for, and how many people have been involved in the process?
The Cultural Olympiad, which is the programme involving communities and young people in cultural events inspired by the 2012 Games, began at the end of the Beijing Olympics. My own involvement and Ruth McKenzie, the director's involvement, is much less than that. We've been involved for just under 3 years. And what we wanted to do was to focus on a festival, because everybody understands a festival. A festival that would be right across the whole of the UK, that would give lots and lots of people opportunities to go and see things, sometimes pay for those opportunities, sometimes they'd be free.
And just looking ahead to the next 12 weeks, what are some of the personal highlights for you? What are some of the things you're most looking forward to?
There's so much. I mean, I'm enjoying at the moment watching the retrospective of Pina Bausch, which, you know, is quite astonishing and plays to standing ovations every night in the Barbican or Sadler's Wells. I'm looking forward to Baron Boehm and the Beethoven cycle at the Proms at the Royal Opera House. I'm looking forward to a day of homeless people performing in the Royal Opera House, courtesy of Streetwise Opera. And I'm going to go down to Stonehenge to see, again, an amazing display around Stonehenge. But look, that's just a few of the things that are going on, and my summer's going to be busy and rich. And I hope that actually lots of people will have a look at the programme, go online or look at the physical programme, and think, there's so much going on and I want to see some of these things. And I think what's been really encouraging so far are the number of people who are new to arts organisations or to artists who are going to see things that they might not otherwise have gone to see. And encouraging new audiences is really important.
Cheers, Tony. That was Tony Hall, chair of the Cultural Olympiad, talking to the curious Katie Bilboa. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. Next week, we'll be intellectualising at this year's Documenta Festival in Kassel and visiting a microtheatre in Madrid, among other things. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, who would be nothing were it not for the trusted support of the editing mastermind, Holly Fisher. Time for one final song this week from his Midori House session. This is Angus Stone with River Love. Thank you for tuning in.
Headed north to San Francisco. Wild horses in my head. See you looking out the window. Will she bring roses when I'm dead? Do I love her for her beauty? Do I love her? She makes me smile. Do I love her? 'Cause it's my duty. But I guess we'll never really know. I guess we'll never really know. Will we ever really know? La la la. La 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 la